It's adventure time. Yes, girls and boys, it's time for adventure. And here's our friend Bill Collins with another episode from the adventures of the Sugar Creek Gang.
It was the laziest day I ever saw. And so hot it would have made any boy want to go fishing or swimming or maybe both. I don't think I was ever so glad in my whole life that school was out. Because just as soon as I saw those big fat fishing worms being turned up by Dad's plow when he was breaking the garden, I knew what I wanted to do. What I had to do, in fact, or the whole day would be spoiled. Right away I laid my rake down, for I was raking the yard, and went out behind our garage to a whole barrelful of empty tin cans, which we'd pretty soon have to haul away to the dump down along Sugar Creek. I picked out the best bait can I could find, threw in a handful of dirt, and started dropping in the biggest, juiciest fishing worms you ever saw. The kind that would make any fish go so crazy with hunger, he'd risk getting caught rather than let the worm wriggle around on the hook all by itself. Like that time I sneaked into Mom's pantry and filled my pockets full of cookies and had my mouth full, too, just as Mom came hurrying down from upstairs where she'd been making the beds. Mom took one look at me and called out sharply, "William Jasper Collins!" And she made a dive for me. She caught me, too, and, but that's a story I don't tell anybody about. Only after the licking quit hurting, I made up my mind I'd never take any more cookies without asking Mom first. You know, I got the best mom in the whole world. Don't think I haven't. I was just a little boy then and didn't know any better. But I guess that licking hurt Mom worse than it did me, because long after I'd quit crying, I saw her eyes were kind of red around the lids. And that night when I said my prayers and had been tucked into bed, she hugged me awful tight. But as I said, that was when I was a little boy, not more than just 7 years old. Now I say my prayers all by myself, climb into bed in the dark, and just call good night down the stairs. I wouldn't let Mom know for the world that I kind of miss being tucked in, but I do just the same. Well, pretty soon I had that bait can almost full of worms. I was thinking how hot it was here in the garden and how cool it would be down at the mouth of the branch and how Roy Gilbert and I would just lie there on the new green grass and watch the lazy specks of foam floating along in the water, and every now and then our bobbers would start acting funny, moving around in circles and ducking under the water like tiny diving birds, and our string of fish would get longer and longer with rock bass and chub and...
Jasper?
Dad's big voice was just like a finger being poked into a great big beautiful soap bubble. It burst my dream all to nothing. And when Dad called me Jasper instead of Bill, I knew he didn't like what I was doing. I set the bait can down in the deep furrow and answered innocently,
"What? What are you up to?"
Dad had the horse's reins slipped around his shoulders and his hands were gripping the plow handles real tight. I didn't know what to say to my dad, so I just called back indifferently,
"Nothing."
I picked up a clod of dirt to throw at a blackbird that was gobbling up all the worms I'd missed.
"Now come here and bring that can of worms with you."
My heart went flop. I couldn't fool Dad in anything, and I knew better than to try. But I could see the whole day being spoiled. Just think of all those fish swimming around in the bottom of the creek, hungry for nice wriggling worms. And just think of how Dad liked to eat fish when they were all cleaned and rolled in cornmeal and fried crisp and brown, the way Mom can fry them. I decided to remind Dad how good fish would taste for supper that night while I picked up the can of worms and walked across the garden to where he was waiting for me. He could always read my mind just like I could read a book. I was in the fifth grade in school, you know. Dad's big, blackish-red eyebrows were down. He had turned around and was sitting on the crosspiece between the plow handles. I was standing there holding the can of worms in both hands. The horses were so hot, white lather was all over them. They'd been sweating so much, that is, that there was lather where the harness rubbed their sides, and you could smell the sweat, and sweat was trickling down Dad's face, too. I guess there never was a hotter day in the spring with little heat waves dancing all over the garden. I kept looking down at my toes, which were digging themselves into the cool, new-turned earth, and Dad kept glaring at my can of worms. I hadn't really done anything wrong, hadn't exactly planned or even thought anything wrong, except maybe I was wishing I didn't have to rake the yard and hating rakes and hoes and garden making and all the work. I guess you'd call it being lazy. Maybe it was.
"Well,
Dad demanded, and then I saw his snow-white teeth gleaming under his red-brown mustache and a twinkle in his eye. It was like a cool dive into Sugar Creek on a smothering hot day. Whenever I saw Dad's teeth shining under his mustache, I knew everything was all right.
Bill Collins.
I felt better than ever, even though his voice was still gruff.
I want you to take that garden rake, clean it off, and put it away in the tool house. And then get your long cane fishing pole and go down to the mouth of the branch, you and Roy Gilbert or some of the boys, and fish and fish and wade in the branch until you get over that terrible case of spring fever. And don't come back until you've caught all the fish that'll bite. You've had a hard school year with all your arithmetic, geography, and science, and you need a rest.
At first, I couldn't believe he meant it. But when he reached out, kind of put his arm around my shoulder and gave me a half hug and said,
I was a boy once, too.
Well, I believed him without trying. You should have seen me carry that long cane fishing pole in one hand and a can of worms in the other, running straight toward the mouth of the branch where I knew Roy'd be waiting for me. For the night before, we'd laid our plans to meet there at 2 o'clock, if we could. But I never dreamed so many things could happen all in one day. Nor that before I got back home again, Roy and I'd have been scared almost to death. Nor that it was going to be the beginning of the most exciting week of my whole life. It happened this way. Roy and I were lying there on the grass on the bank of the creek, just like I told you we would. Our fishing poles reached far out over the water, and funny-looking, enormous-eyed, four-winged dragonflies nosed around our lines like hummingbirds around Mom's morning glories back home. All of a sudden, my bobber, which was nothing more than a big cork out of Mom's vinegar jug, started acting like it was alive. It moved around in a funny little half-circle, kind of slow at first, and then plunk, just like that. It ducked under, making a big splash. The end of my pole bent clear down and struck the water with a smack. I knew before I could think that I'd hooked a big fish. I grabbed my end of the pole quicker than anything and held on tight. Roy told me afterward that my eyes stuck out like a dragonfly's when I was pulling that fish in. And my line didn't break either, because I had a brand new one. That's another reason why I knew my dad liked me, maybe better than my dad ever liked his boy before. When I'd gone to get my fishing pole out of the tool shed an hour before, it had had a brand new line on it with a reel and everything. Dad acted surprised when he saw it, but there was a twinkle in his gray eyes, and I knew he'd bought it for me. Maybe you think I wasn't scared, though, when my bare feet slipped on the edge of the bank and flew right out from under me and went down kersplash into the water, still holding onto that fishing pole for dear life. Roy was standing on the shore, jumping up and down and yelling at the top of his lungs and screaming at me what to do and not to let go of the pole. Let me tell you a little bit about the gang, in case some of you aren't acquainted with us. We're the finest bunch of boys you ever heard of. I reckon there never will be a gang of boys in the whole world that'll have any more fun than we did. There was little Jim Foote, who was the littlest one of us, and who always obeyed his parents and was sort of a mascot for us because he was so good. Anyway, he seemed to bring us good luck whenever he was along. We didn't care if he was about the most religious one of our gang, because he was so likable. And he wasn't any sissy, either. Say, that little fellow was brave. Why, once when there was a bear after us, and little Jim was carrying Big Jim's rifle. But, well, that's another part of the story, which I can't tell you until a little later. Well, there was little Jim and poetry and... But let me tell you about Leslie Thompson. We called him Poetry because he was always quoting a verse or two of poetry. Everything he saw would start him off, and sometimes we'd have to shut him up or the rest of us couldn't get a chance to say a word. He was fatter than anything, almost as broad as he was tall, and his voice was changing so that it sounded awful squawky. He used to sing soprano in the junior choir in our church, but now he couldn't sing at all, or wouldn't. And folks just don't seem to understand that when a boy's voice gets all squawky like a duck with a bad cold, he's terribly bashful about singing or talking in public. It didn't mean that Poetry was any less interested in church at all, because once I stayed all night at his house and we slept together before we went to bed, he got right down on his knees and prayed first. And when he got through saying his little poem prayer, which he'd learned when he was little, he added a lot of words of his own, just like he was talking to somebody right in the room. And I guess maybe he was. kind of scared me at first, but I didn't let him see a stubborn old tear that got in my eyes about that time. Anyway, that's how I learned to add things to my prayer, too. Well, Poetry was always acting mysterious and was going to be a detective someday, he said. He was always getting into mischief. And then there was Circus Brown, whose real name was Daniel August Brown, and whatever his parents wanted to give him such a long-legged name for, I don't know. We called him Circus because he was so acrobatic. He could turn handsprings, walk on his hands, turn the pinwheel, and he could chin up a tree quicker than anybody I ever saw. Besides Dragonfly, Poetry, Little Jim, Circus, and me, there was Big Jim. We called him Big Jim because he and Little Jim had the same names, and we didn't want to get them mixed up. Big Jim was the leader of the gang, and he knew all the things a leader ought to know. He belonged to a Boy Scout patrol once before he'd moved into our neighborhood and was what they call a first-class scout. First, he'd been a tenderfoot, and then a second class, and then a first class. He could have gone on to qualify for Star or Life or Eagle rank, but his folks had to move, and there wasn't any scout troop where he lived. Besides, you have to be 12 years old to be even a tenderfoot, so that would have meant that Dragonfly, Poetry, Little Jim, and I would have been left out. So Big Jim just called us the gang. Say, Big Jim was strong, almost as strong as my dad, I reckon, and he used almost perfect English. He knew exactly what to do in case anybody fainted. He could make a tourniquet for stopping the flow of blood when anybody was bleeding terribly, and he could tie the 21 different kinds of knots, such as the Magnus hitch and the fisherman's bend, the half hitch, and the bowline knot. He was the catcher of our ball team and could knock more home runs than any of us. He could jump the farthest and was the best fighter I ever saw. Only we didn't get into many fights on account of Big Jim kept other boys in the neighborhood from starting anything, they being scared of him. Poetry could quote more poetry than any of us. Circus could climb a tree the fastest and do more acrobatic stunts. And Dragonfly was able to see bigger things and see the farthest. And Little Jim was more of a Christian than the whole lot of us put together. As for me, guess I was just an ordinary boy. I didn't even have a nickname except just plain Bill, which is short for William. Well, now that I've said that, let me get back to the story. You remember last time we were down by the creek and Dad had given me permission to go with Dragonfly and do some fishing. He knew I had to get it out of my system. And you know, before long we had a strike and that pole was bent down to the water almost. And Roy was standing on the shore jumping up and down and yelling at the top of his lungs and screaming for me not to let go of the pole. I saw him. He was a big black bass, 2 feet long. I could barely touch the bottom of the creek with my feet while I was feeling the heavy pulling and jerking of that big fish on the end of the line and thinking about my new overalls being all wet and what Mom would say when I got home. Roy got a hold of one of my hands and started to pull me out. Give me the pole, quick! And then, just like it had happened to me, it happened to him, too. His feet slipped, and there we were, both of us in the water. Of course, we could both swim, so there wasn't any danger of drowning. You know, everybody ought to learn how to swim when he's little, because you can never tell when he'll either have to swim or drown. Well, between the two of us, we landed the fish. It was a big black bass, all right, only it was about 14 inches long, or maybe 12, instead of 2 feet like Roy said it was. And that's how come he came to get the name Dragonfly. His eyes were bigger than his head. Anyway, he was always seeing things twice as big as they were. He kind of liked the name, and so did I. I felt quite proud that I'd thought of it first. Boy, I tell you, that water felt good. Now that we're all wet, we just as well go in swimming. Besides, we'll have to let our clothes dry, won't we? And they'll dry quicker than anything hanging out on those bushes while we swim. Dad hadn't told me I couldn't go swimming, I guess. He figured maybe I'd like to, and he didn't want me to be tempted to disobey him and then have to have a licking. Dragonfly's parents hadn't told him not to either. So, in about a minute and a half, we had that 12-inch bass. Oh, well, maybe he was only about 11 inches long, fastened on a stringer and swimming around in his jail over in the branch, which empties into the creek right near where we'd been fishing. Our clothes were hanging on some bushes, drying, and we were out there in that fine, clear water, splashing, swimming, diving, and having the time of our lives. Understand, we were waiting for our clothes to dry. We weren't just swimming for the fun of it, of course. We stayed in maybe a half hour, having a grand old time and wishing the gang was there. Anyway, when you haven't been in swimming for a long time and it's such a terribly hot day, time goes pretty fast. And you forget about everything else except, well, how much fun you're having. It was Dragonfly who saw it first. Saw him, rather. All of a sudden, Dragonfly stopped splashing and yelling and hissed to me, "Quick, Val, get down under the water. Somebody's coming." We both dropped so only our chins and noses were sticking out, looking maybe like a couple of turtles with only their noses showing above the water. Dragonfly whispered, "Look, it's an old man with long white whiskers, and he's coming right straight this way." I don't see anything. And then I did see him, a short, fat man, about as big around as a barrel, bareheaded, with whiskers, and long, shaggy white hair that reached clear down to his belt. Only he didn't have any belt on account of he was wearing a pair of old overalls. He had on dark glasses, and he shuffled along like he couldn't see very well. He looked just like an old tramp. Itinerants, Dan called them, people that kind of come through the area and, well, you don't know what they're up to, and it's kind of scary when you see one. And he looked pretty fierce, and all of a sudden, Dragonfly said, "He spied our clothes!" Sure enough, he had. And he was pushing his way through the tall weeds straight toward them. We knew right then we'd better do something quick, for I had a brand new knife in my overall pocket, and Dragonfly had a watch in his. "Let's scream like 100 wild Indians," Dragonfly said. It sounded like a good idea, so we both let out a yell as loud as we could, making it sound as fierce as if we were a whole tribe of Indians. Only I knew it must have sounded like two kids half scared to death, which it did. But the old man acted like he was deaf or something, for he didn't even look around. He was standing right near where our clothes were hanging, and in a second he was going through our pockets. He found Dragonfly's watch first and held it up in the sunlight close to his big dark glasses, brushed it against his long white whiskers like he was brushing dust off of it, put it to his ear and listened, and then shook his head as if he couldn't hear a thing. My watch!" Dragonfly gulped, and I'd never seen him so scared before. And being scared is kind of like getting the measles. It's catching. Dragonfly's face made me afraid, too. But if getting scared is contagious, so is getting angry. Pretty soon we were both so mad we knew we were going to do something fierce in just about a minute. We yelled again, a wild, blood-curdling scream. But do you think that made any difference? Not a bit. "He's deaf!" And I believed Dragonfly. And when I saw my new knife going down that old man's pocket, I began to get madder than ever. And then the old man just naturally picked up our clothes and slung them over his shoulder and waddled back through the tall grass and weeds, whistling. Whistling, mind you. We knew he couldn't go home without our clothes, only at that time I didn't know much of anything. I was so mad. And so was Dragonfly. We knew we'd have to do something, and you can bet your life we did. We climbed up that creek bank, picked up a couple of clubs, and whooped it up like a whole tribe of Indians, swinging our clubs and yelling, "Come back here with our clothes! Stop or we'll shoot!" And about everything frightening we could think of. But that big, round barrel of a man with his long white hair shining in the sunlight just turned around and glared at us. He seemed to know the lay of the land there, too, for he shuffled quickly to the right and tossed our clothes right over into the middle of a briar patch and said gruffly, "Help yourself." Briar patch, mind you. And both of us barefoot and stark naked. Why, we'd be scratched half to death trying to get those clothes. That was too much. We both made a dive for him, and before you could say Jack Robinson, we caught up with him, and not because we could run faster, for he was faster than a deer, but because he stumbled and fell and rolled down the hill. We stumbled over him, landing right on top of him and getting our arms and legs all tangled up like an octopus doing an acrobatic stunt. "Stop! Don't hurt me. I'll give up." And then, as if he was crazy, he started quoting poetry. "Jack and Jill went up the hill to fetch a pail of water. Jack fell down and broke his crown, and Jill came tumbling after." In a jiffy, those long whiskers were off, and long hair and dark glasses, and we were looking straight into the mischievous blue eyes of Leslie Poetry Thompson, who started to laugh and laugh as loud as he could and quoted from The Night Before Christmas. "He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly." Poetry sprang to his feet and began to dance a jig and to sing, "Hey diddle-diddle, the cat and the fiddle, the cow jumped over the moon. The little dog laughed to see such sport, and the dish ran away with a spoon." He held up Dragonfly's watch and my knife and started all over again about the cat and the fiddle. Well, I was still mad, and so was Dragonfly. And as much as we liked good old mischievous Poetry, we made him wade out into that briar patch and get our clothes, which were still a little wet. And then we all went in swimming. Poetry got ducked again and again for being so smart. Only it was just like trying to duck a rubber barrel. He wouldn't stay under, and he could swim and dive like a fish. "Where'd you get your whiskers?" I asked when we were dressing. "And your dark glasses and your long hair," Dragonfly added. "Wouldn't you like to know?" And then Poetry lowered his voice and looked around mysteriously. I found them. "Found them?" Dragonfly and I asked in chorus. "In the old hollow sycamore tree down along the swamp." "Well, how do you suppose they got there?" Poetry looked at me scornfully as if I were too ignorant to know much about mysterious things. "Oh, they grew there just like the moss." "Well, maybe there's some robber or something around here." Dragonfly tried on the dark glasses. Poetry looked pretty serious when Dragonfly said that, and that, too, was like getting the measles. The more we thought about it, the more we began to wonder if Dragonfly might not be right. That old sycamore tree was the biggest tree around here anywhere. The biggest around, well, anyway. And about 3 or 4 feet from the ground was a big opening, and inside it was all hollow, large enough for three of us boys to stand in at the same time. That is, three the size of little Jim, Dragonfly, and me. Poetry just about filled it himself. In fact, he was so fat this year he couldn't even get inside the opening. The tree grew about 15 feet from a steep precipice that dropped straight down a rocky bank to Sugar Creek. It was an awful lonely place down in that part of the woods, and none of us boys ever went there alone because our folks didn't want us to, but we sometimes went there together. Somebody had started the rumor that the old swamp was haunted, and that meant ghosts. Well, none of us boys believed in ghosts. We weren't exactly hoping to meet one without Big Jim along, who could have made short work of any ghost in a jiffy. He was so strong. But Poetry, you could never tell what he was going to do next. And as I told you, he'd already made up his mind he was going to be a detective when he grew up, and he wasn't afraid of anything. The three of us sat there looking pretty sober-faced, talking about what we'd better do, and each of us tried on the disguise just to see how we looked with it on. And then, all of a sudden, it was 5 o'clock, and we knew we'd better be getting home quick or our folks would be worrying about us. That was one of Big Jim's rules, by the way. We weren't to cause our parents any worry if we could help it. Dragonfly made me take the fish even though we had both caught it, and tomorrow we decided we'd get Big Jim and Circus and Little Jim and the six of us, and we'd go down along the swamp and investigate that old hollow tree. We'd sneak up on the place and attack it from ambush. Of course, there wasn't anything to it, but you could never tell. It felt mighty good to be carrying that big fish home for Dad to see, although I kept wondering what Mom would say about my wrinkled overalls. They were pressed so nicely when I'd gone away. Mighty good to be carrying that big fish home for Dad to see, although I kept wondering what Mom would say about my wrinkled overalls. They were pressed so nicely when I'd gone away. But Mom was as good a mother as Dad was a father. She was standing in the kitchen doorway when I came up past the barn and the garden carrying my big black bass, the fishing pole, and the bait can. Dad was washing his face and hands in a big wash basin under our grape arbor, which ran along the side of the garage. He straightened up with soap suds all over his face and neck and looked me over from head to foot. And then his eyes lit up proudly while I held up the fish for him to see. Dad was looking at the fish, and Mom was looking at my soiled overalls. "Hey, it's wonderful," Dad said.
"They're terrible,"
Mom said. I didn't have a chance to be either glad or sad now, did I? But I was worried some just the same, because I didn't want to make Mom feel bad. "I'll wash them myself."
"Oh, he won't need washing, only cleaning and skinning."
Dad meant the fish, of course, not me. And just then the telephone rang, and Mom had to go answer it, so I had a minute to be happy about my big fish. Dad brought a ruler and measured it.
10 1/2 inches.
And he gave me the other half of that hug he'd started to give me earlier in the afternoon. Well, right away, supper was ready, and as soon as I had washed my face and hands and combed my hair, I wet my hair a lot before I combed it so I wouldn't look like I'd gotten it wet going in swimming, and we sat down to supper. I was still feeling kind of heavy around the heart on account of my overalls, even though I was as cheerful as anything on the outside and as hungry as a bear on the inside. Mom's big, soft brown eyes kept watching me all the time. We all bowed our heads quietly before eating. Hungry as I was, I kept my eyes shut all the time Dad was praying, which wasn't very long. Dad knew how hungry a boy could get at mealtime, and most any time. He was a boy once himself. Oh, Dad was a real Christian, all right. I knew that not only because he prayed and read the Bible and went to church, but because he acted like one toward Mom and me and everybody else. I was just itching to tell him about the whole story, how I caught the fish, that is, how a dragonfly and I caught it, but I couldn't on account of not wanting Mom to know I fell in the creek. But pretty soon, when Mom was waiting on the table and was pouring a second glass of milk for me, she reached down and kissed the top of my head, just like I was a little boy. And she whispered in my ear, "Don't worry, Billy boy. I know you didn't do it on purpose." And then she went around to her chair and sat down again. After that, it was the easiest thing in the world to talk. Dad laughed and laughed and wiped his eyes over me and Dragonfly falling into the water. Well, that night, after I'd scrubbed my feet good and gone up to bed, calling good night at the top of the stairs, I stood beside my bed a long time before getting down on my knees to say my prayers. I looked out the window at the moonlight shining on the barn and the garage and the new garden. I could even see the little green tops of onions set in long rows across the garden. And then I looked up at the Milky Way and stretched like a big white bow across the sky and at all the thousands of stars. And I just kind of felt that God had made them. And I couldn't help but be glad I had a real Dad and Mom who loved me and tried to teach me about Him. Somehow, I couldn't help but think maybe He was like my mother and father, only more wonderful and a lot greater. He had made an awful pretty world, and He must have liked boys a lot, because He'd sent His own son down to earth to be a boy Himself once. I knelt down and said my little poem prayer and then added some words of my own, which I can't remember now. I felt just like telling Jesus I loved Him like I did my parents, and maybe even more, but I was scared to. But I did love Him just the same, and I guess He can hear a boy's thoughts anyway, the same as His words. Only it's better to use real words when you can. Huh, I tell you, that nice clean bed felt good, even if it was hot. The pillow was so big and soft and why, it was wet. Not much, but like someone had sprinkled a few drops of water on it. And that's how I found out I'd been crying a little bit. I hadn't even known it at all. I sighed a great big happy sigh, and the next thing I knew, it was morning. Say, that was the finest morning you ever saw. The big red sun was just peeping up over the horizon like he wasn't quite awake yet and hated to get up. The birds were singing like everything, and right up in the top of our big walnut tree, which grew on the other side of the garden, and where we had the biggest swing in the whole neighborhood, and where the gang liked to play, was a robin hollering for all he was worth. "Jasper Collins, get up, get up!" I like robins, though, even if they did call me Jasper. And down on the ground, with his head cocked on one side, listening for a worm or something, was another robin, with his red breast in the sunlight. He must have seen a worm all right, for all of a sudden he turned like a flash and was pulling at something with his big black and yellow bill. Sure enough, in a second there was a big, long fishing worm in his mouth, twisting and squirming like it was on a hook. "You know, it really doesn't hurt fishing worms to be put on a hook," Dad said once. Dad's sort of a scientist farmer, and he said something about it being like a minor irritation or something, which means it doesn't hurt much. Kind of like a boy getting his neck and ears washed with soap and water when he'd rather wash them himself by swimming and diving in Sugar Creek. Pretty soon that robin flew up into a fork of the walnut tree where there was a whole nest full of little quintuplets waiting for their breakfast. Think of eating worms for breakfast. Worms! Blah! I dressed in a hurry because today was to be the big day. Right after dinner, the gang would all get together and Poetry would tell us what he'd found in the hollow tree down by the haunted swamp. We'd all arm ourselves with bows and arrows and slingshots, and with a big club for little Jim, and the fun would begin. First thing, though, was getting through the morning, which would be awful long because all of us boys helped our folks in the morning, and that was Big Jim's rule. I guess there never was a boy that liked to work unless he could imagine his work was play, but Mom had been trying to teach me ever since I was a little that work came first and then play. I guess she was right. And then, too, if you really love your parents, you'll like to do things that make them happy. I helped Mom wipe the dishes, which most boys think is a girl's job, but it isn't when you don't have any girls in the family. I finished raking the lawn, built a fire, burned all the dead grass and leaves and gathered up all the tin cans and things that somehow had gotten scattered all over the barnyard, mainly because I'd been using them for imaginary golf balls. I dropped the potato slices with the eyes in them into the long, deep rows Dad had made across the garden and stepped on them with my bare feet so they'd be pressed down into the dirt better and would grow quicker. Maybe you think that wasn't fun, feeling the cool, damp dirt oozing up between my toes. Pretty soon, it was dinner time, and we had fish for dinner. Dad asked, "What kind of bait did you use to catch this bass?" And I answered between mouthfuls, having a hard time to eat slow on account of having to meet the gang at 1 o'clock, "Well, just plain worms. Why?" "Oh, I just wondered. I found a nice little chub on the inside of him, and the little chub was full of fishing worms." I looked up surprised. That meant that first I'd hooked a little chub, and then the big bass had come along and had swallowed the chub. And right away I knew what kind of bait to use for bass the next time I wanted to catch one. "It'll be all right to fish for bass today. You won't run any risk getting arrested." "What?" "Well, the bass fishing season opens today. If the game warden had seen you catch that one yesterday, it would have been too bad." Well, at 1:50, I was ready to go down to the spring where the gang had agreed to meet. It was Thursday, and we always met there on Thursday afternoons at 1 o'clock if we could. I ran upstairs to get my binoculars, thinking maybe we'd need them. On the way down again, I stopped by to fasten the strap around my neck, and all of a sudden, I went numb all over. Pop had the radio going, listening to the afternoon news, and just that minute, I heard the announcer say, "Warned to be on the lookout for a man suspected of being an accomplice in a bank holdup. It's believed he's hiding somewhere in the swamp. He's described as having black hair and eyes, and..." I couldn't make out where, because there was some static that came in just then. When I got downstairs and looked at myself in the mirror, I was as white as a sheet. But I hurried out of the door as quickly so the folks wouldn't see me and ran as fast as I could through the woods toward the spring, my heart beating wildly because what I'd heard and because it looked like maybe we were going to have a chance to help catch a real robber. I was the first one of the gang to get to the spring, and Circus was the last. He had had a hard time persuading his parents how important it was not to miss a meeting. Circus's folks, his dad especially, never did understand boys very well, although his dad must have been a boy once himself. But grown-up people are funny in that way. They kind of forget that inside a boy there's something that just makes him want to keep his promise to the gang. And I tell you, it's pretty hard to give in and obey your parents when they don't understand. But we had to, though. Big Jim said he'd read it in the Bible as plain as day. Children, obey your parents. And Little Jim, who wasn't any relation to Big Jim at all, only he had the same name, said it was true because he saw it in the Bible with his own eyes. Big Jim said, "Besides, if you ever want to become a Boy Scout, one of the qualifications is obedience." Well, pretty soon we were all there. Big Jim had a mysterious package under his arm. Circus climbed a small elm sapling almost as soon as he got there and was swaying in the top, back and forth, and looking every bit like a monkey in the zoo. Dragonfly and Poetry and Little Jim and I started tumbling around in the grass like kittens having a good time. All six of us boys were as tickled to see each other as if we hadn't been together in years. The spring, you know, comes bubbling up out of a hole in the rock at the bottom of a steep hill, only about 20 feet from the creek. Dad had had the water tested to see if it was all right, and it was. Just that minute, a big green shikepoke came flying up the creek with his long neck sticking out in front of him like the long handle on my green coaster wagon. His wings were flapping and driving him through the air awful fast. A shikepoke is a real green heron, Dad says, but it's the most idiotic-looking bird you ever saw. I just gotten my binoculars focused on him and was following him up the creek with my eyes when Poetry was reminded of a verse from Hiawatha. Away he went in his squawky voice, which was about as squawky as the big quoak heron's, which goes quoking up the creek at night, sounding like a young rooster learning to crow. Then the little Hiawatha learned of every bird its language, learned their names and all their secrets, how they built their nests in summer, how they hid themselves in winter, talked with them whenever he met them, called them Hiawatha's chickens. Poetry finished the first verse and started the second when something came swinging down from up above and landed right on top of him. Circus had caught hold of the top of the elm sapling where he was sitting and swung himself out. The top of that tree had bent right over to the ground and brought him down with it. When he let go, the tree top flew right back up again. In another minute, we were all trying it, each one climbing a tree and swinging from one to another or down to the ground, whichever we wanted to do. You can do that with elm trees, you know. But all this was just wasting time, so pretty soon Poetry looked at me and I looked at him, and we decided to ask Big Jim to call a meeting so he could show us what he'd found yesterday. First, though, Big Jim opened his package, and there was a whole packet of paper drinking cups. We knew right away that what they were for, because we'd studied in school about how everyone ought to have individual drinking cups for health reasons. Big Jim picked up the old rusty cup that was standing there in the rock and which everybody in the country had used for years, maybe. We all stood solemn-like, wondering what he was going to do. First he held it up for us to see, and then he said dramatically, making a play out of it, "You never can tell when someone's going to drink out of it. Someone who's has some terrible disease, maybe. And when the next person who uses the cup may become affected." Then Big Jim set the cup down on the rock, and with another rock he pounded and hammered it until he'd smashed it all flat. And then he tossed it into the weeds, and pretty soon we had a sign up which said, "Please use paper drinking cups." When we were finished, those cups were fastened up on a tree by the spring in a little tin container, just like you see in the cities, or in most any public place there. All of a sudden, Poetry was gone, and then in a minute later, he came hobbling down the hill like an old man with a long beard and long white hair and with dark glasses on. Dragonfly pinched me on the arm so hard I couldn't help but say, "Ouch!" And then I shut up like a clam. Poetry said in the quavery voice of an old man,
"Howdy, boys. Do you reckon maybe a feller can get a drink of water at the spring here?"
Little Jim looked as white as a sheet for a minute. Circus's monkey face was as sober as a funeral. Dragonfly and I were holding our hands over our mouths to keep from laughing. I thought even Big Jim looked a little bit worried, for he was a boy even if he was our leader. He wasn't so much bigger than Poetry at that.
"Where's my old rusty tin cup?"
Poetry's voice quavered, and it didn't sound any more like Poetry than anything. But Circus saw his bare feet and noticed how fat he was, and a second later Poetry was standing bareheaded and looking surprised and disgusted, and Circus was already trying the disguise on himself to see how he'd look. Well, Big Jim called a meeting, and Poetry, Dragonfly, and I told him everything we knew, even to the radio announcement. Big Jim took it all pretty calmly, but I could see he was as much excited on the inside as the rest of us. Little Jim said, "Maybe I'd better run home and ask Mother if I can go."
"Not much you don't. It's going to be a secret, because if you're afraid..."
"I'm not afraid, Circus." Well, of course he was afraid, and so were all of us. But a boy likes to be scared a little bit. It feels good. So pretty soon we were there, right down along the swamp, walking cautiously toward the old hollow sycamore tree. It was Dragonfly who saw the man first, for as I told you before, he had the sharpest eyes of any of us.
"Psst! There's a funny-looking man."
He dropped flat on the ground, which was a signal for all of us to do the same thing. It didn't do Poetry much good to lie down, because anybody couldn't help but see him, although maybe they wouldn't think he was a human being a big fat steer or a horse or something. Sure enough, there was a man all right, about 20 yards from the tree, and walking straight toward it. Or rather, he was just walking along kind of lazy-like, but going toward the tree just the same, and he was whistling some kind of tune which sounded like Old Black Joe. Big Jim turned his face toward us and raised his fingers to his lips and said, "Shh." And his eyes said, "Don't you dare make a noise, any of you." And then he handed the binoculars to me. I noticed particularly that the man looked awful young to be a bank robber, and he had coal black hair. When we'd all had to look with the binoculars, we knew that something was really mysterious, for the man was digging around in the old tree.
"He's looking for something."
Maybe Poetry is thinking of the whiskers and glasses and the wig. It's a good thing the grass was tall where we were, or the man might have seen us. And once he stopped what he was doing and looked around quick as if he'd heard something, and then he went on whistling Old Black Joe and walked away following the creek. Something must have scared him, for pretty soon he started to run for all he was worth. I guess we lay there for maybe 5 minutes waiting for Big Jim to say we could get up. We could see from the expression on his face what he was thinking, that he was thinking pretty hard. Pretty soon he said, "It won't do any good for us to act like we know anything special. Let's just get up and be natural, like a bunch of boys having a good time." Circus was about the only one of us that didn't have any trouble acting natural when he was trying to. He yawned and stretched and said,
"Boy,
Feels good to lie here in the shade. Only there wasn't any shade there at all except what poetry made, he being so awful fat. So, with all of us acting natural, or nearly so, we just moved along gang fashion until we got to the tree. Big Jim made us all stand back and keep on trying to act natural, which was pretty hard to do. We could hear him digging around in the tree with little Jim's stick. Pretty soon he let out a low whistle, and I saw him shove something into his pocket and keep right on digging around. There was a queer look on his face when he came back to where we were. And then all of a sudden, there was a shot up the creek, and then another, and another. It didn't take us long to get back to the spring, I can tell you, for that look in Big Jim's face and those gunshots scared us plenty. We were all so excited we could hardly talk, which was all right because we were supposed to do nothing but run anyway, which we did. At the spring, Big Jim took out of his pocket a dirty brown envelope, and he started to open it when we all jumped suddenly like we were shot. We could hear footsteps coming up along the top of the hill. We all sat there so tense we couldn't move. Big Jim shoved the envelope in his pocket and started whistling, and Poetry rolled over on his side and yawned and said, "Boy, am I sleepy. In winter, I get up at night and dress by yellow candlelight. In summer, quite the other way, I have to go to bed by day." Little Jim sidled over to Big Jim, and his right hand crept into his so he wouldn't feel so scared. Circus and Dragonfly started a wrestling match, and I got my binoculars and focused them on a snake which was swimming along in the creek. The snake must have heard or seen us, for he ducked under the water and didn't come up again until he was almost all the way across and about 10 feet farther down the creek. All this time, we knew the footsteps were coming nearer, even though we couldn't hear them. I guess we were all pretty relieved when we looked up and saw it was my dad with a big pail in his hand coming for spring water. He stood looking at us and at our sign on the tree and the paper drinking cups, and then he filled his pail and said, "Well, you better come home at 5:30 tonight, Bill. This is Thursday, you know." You see, Thursday night is prayer meeting night in our church, and some kids might think it's kind of goofy to go to prayer meeting, but I didn't, because I've been going ever since I was old enough to be carried there. And when you got a mother and father like mine, you think prayer meeting on Thursday night is all right. In fact, I felt sorry for circuses folks who didn't go any place on Thursday night except to places where they shouldn't, circuses' dad especially. He was always getting drunk. Circus's mom was really a good mother, but she didn't have a chance with so many children, and all of them girls but one. Circus's folks didn't know anything at all about the Bible. Didn't seem fair for a boy to have that kind of parents, but that's the kind Circus had. And all he knew about things like that was what he'd learned from Little Jim and poetry and me, but mostly from Little Jim. Circus had already quit swearing because Little Jim didn't like to hear it, and Circus was the only one of our gang that did swear. Big Jim wouldn't stand for it, so as quick as he knew it was wrong, he quit. Well, just as my dad reached the top of the hill with his pail of water, he turned around and said without even being excited,
"Maybe you boys would be interested to know that about 20 minutes ago, the sheriff caught a boy bank robber down along the swamp. The robber is on his way to jail now, to the hospital first to get well of his wounds. They had to shoot him."
Little Jim looked kind of pale. I knew right away he was thinking about that robber, for pretty soon when Dad was gone, he said, I hope he doesn't die without being sorry. Mother says unless a man repents of his sin and lets Jesus come into his heart before he dies, he won't ever be saved and can't go to heaven at all." After Little Jim had said that, we all kept still for a minute, thinking different things. I wondered whether the bank robber's mother would go to jail to see him, and how awful it would make her feel to have that kind of a boy. I wished every boy in the world had a mother like mine, or Little Jim's, or Poetry's. I bet there wouldn't be many bad boys in the world if they had, would there? We decided we'd better find a more secluded place in the spring before we opened that brown envelope, because at the spring you can never tell when somebody's going to come for a drink. So we climbed up on top of a high hill over on the east side of the woods to a big rock where we sometimes had our meetings. And in a few minutes we were all there, looking at a rough drawing of some kind with scrawly writing on it. Right in the middle of the page was a bed that looked like a hospital cot, and in the bed was an old man with a nurse standing there with a glass of water. The old man was saying, "More, please." And alongside the bed was a funny, crooked line twisting along like a snake, and a little bird was in a tree close by singing, "Sweet, sweet, sweet." There were letters and numbers and other lines running off from the one that looked like a snake. "It doesn't make sense," Poetry exclaimed, and it looked like he was right. I kept watching Big Jim's face, for I knew he was thinking. And say, Big Jim had the kindest face you ever saw, with clear blue eyes and a chin that had a great big dimple right in the middle. There wasn't any sense to my noticing the yellow and black fuzz on his upper lip when I should have been thinking about the map or whatever it was supposed to be, unless it was because some people call other people's faces maps. Anyway, I thought that Big Jim was old enough, almost, to begin shaving, and I kind of envied him being that old, for that little mustache meant that Big Jim was almost a man. I guess every boy can hardly wait until he gets to be a man. It was Dragonfly who saw it first, and in a jiffy he was jumping up and down and hollering for all he was worth.
I've got it! I've got it!
Big Jim shut him up quickly, all of us did, in fact. Look, that nurse standing there means the old man is sick. He's asking for more water, and if you put sick and more together, you have sycamore. It stands for that old tree. I guess we were all pretty excited right that minute, and we must have made a lot of noise, because Big Jim said, calm down. Now the Dragonfly had seen it. It was as plain as day to the rest of us. And that snake crawling is a creek. And the word singing, sweet, 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 means Sugar Creek. Well, it was just like fitting together a jigsaw puzzle, figuring out that map, only it was harder. It looks like we might be on the trail of something that could be quite a discovery. It was just like fitting together a jigsaw puzzle, figuring out that map that Big Jim had found on the hollow sycamore tree. Only it was harder. We were all sitting there on the rock with a map spread out between us, racking our brains to decide what the funny lines and words meant. From the tree there was an arrow with the number 20 written on it, pointing straight east. That is, if the directions on the map were the same as those on any ordinary map. On the end of the arrow was the word China, and that didn't make any sense. Not until little Jim said, kind of quiet-like, as if he was afraid somebody'd make fun of his idea, my granddaddy was a missionary in China, and Daddy says China's right straight down through the center of the earth. Without knowing it, he had solved the puzzle for us, for that meant go 20 feet east and dig straight down, and there we'd find whatever it was, the money maybe, and which had been stolen from the bank. We all jumped up and started toward the sycamore tree with Big Jim in the lead. Having to go slow because little Jim couldn't run as fast as the rest of us, we got there in about 6 minutes or a little more. Well, there we were without a ruler or a tape line, so how could we know how far 20 feet or 20 yards were without something to measure with? We weren't nearly as scared as we had been when we were there the first time because we knew the robber had been caught, but we were plenty excited, though. Somebody will have to run home for a ruler or a tape line, Big Jim said. We all looked at each other, and none of us wanted to go, knowing it was so near supper time that whoever went might not get to come back. His folks might not understand how important it was, and he couldn't tell them. Let's roll poetry over 7 times, and that'll make 21 feet, because he's just 3 feet around, Circus suggested. Poetry turned red and gave Circus a savage look. I'm 35 inches, and you wouldn't know your arithmetic well enough to divide 20 feet by 35 inches. Maybe if he'd drink a pint of water, he'd be exactly 3 feet, and 3 times 7 is 21. And then we could measure back the length of his foot, which is just 12 inches, and we'd find the right place. Poetry looked at Dragonfly more disgusted than ever. He was especially ashamed of having such long feet, but he couldn't help it. I'm just 4 feet tall, little Jim said, and in a jiffy he was lying down with his feet against the sycamore tree and with his body pointing straight east. Well, that looked like a good idea, so we just used Little Jim for a measuring stick. And pretty soon we were what was supposed to be 20 feet from the tree. Poetry lay down and rolled over 7 times, too, just to show he was a good sport, and there wasn't much difference between the two measurements. But we knew we'd figured wrong, for all around there the grass was fresh and green, and nobody had ever buried anything there unless it was a long time ago. So maybe the map meant 20 yards instead of 20 feet. Big Jim looked at his watch and then at me and said, uh-oh, it's 5:30. We'll have to go home to supper. Of course, we felt pretty disappointed, but we agreed to meet again the next afternoon at 1 o'clock, if we could. And Big Jim would bring a long 50-foot tape line, his father being a carpenter. I'll bring a gunny sack to put the money in, little Jim volunteered. But we didn't laugh at him, because sometimes his ideas turned out to be all right. Maybe I never told you that Portree was my very best friend, but he was. When I got home and had helped Dad with the chores and we were eating supper, the phone rang. It was Portree's parents saying if we'd like, we could ride to church with them in their new car. I was glad, because that meant Portree and I could sit together in church, that is, if we promised to be good and not get into mischief. But it would be a hard promise for any boy to keep, especially if he was sitting beside Portree, even in church. His being mischievous didn't mean he was a bad boy, though, because I knew he wasn't. Some boys are made different than others, I guess, and Portree was that kind. Right after supper, Dad had me drive the cows down the lane to the pasture.
Be sure to shut the gate and hook it good and tight.
He called to me just as I left the barnyard driving our five big Holstein milk cows.
I will.
With a long stick, which I always used when I was driving the cows, I trudged along happily thinking about tomorrow and wondering what we'd find, or if the map had been drawn by some crazy person and didn't have anything to do with a bank robbery at all. That was the oldest and dirtiest envelope I'd ever seen, and the map looked like it had been drawn 100 years ago. Well, 20 years ago anyway, or maybe 10. Pretty soon I heard Mom's voice calling me to hurry or he'd be late for church. When I got up close to the house, I heard her complain a little bit to Dad.
Whatever makes that boy so irresponsible? Oh, he's a dreamer, dear. He'll be all right if we give him time.
Well, pretty soon Portree was there, and we were all in their car going up the road lickety-sizzle toward our church, which was maybe 2 miles from where we lived. You know, we boys all lived out in the country in about the prettiest spot in the world, I reckon. Right across the road from our church, which was a country church, was a 3-room schoolhouse. It wasn't the school we all went to, because we had a little 1-room school of our own right in our neighborhood. It didn't take us long to get there. It wasn't even dark yet, and our car was the first one to drive up in the big, wide churchyard and park. Soon people came from all directions, and the service began. Portree and I held the songbook together, and I noticed he didn't look at the page more than half the time. He just growled along, singing a sort of bass, knowing most of the words from memory. He liked Portree so well. The meeting wasn't exactly the kind to appeal to real red-blooded boys like us, but we liked the music and the minister's prayer, which wasn't too long, and his sermon, which was easy to understand and wasn't too long either. And then they had what they called testimonies. Different people stood up and said nice things about Jesus and how they loved him and how their prayers were answered, things like that. I just sat there kind of trembling on the inside because I loved Jesus too, maybe as much as any of them did. And I was wishing the minister would say,
"Now, if any of the boys and girls would like to say a word, we'll ask all the older people to keep still for a few minutes."
But he didn't say that. So I just sat there wishing I'd get up anyway and didn't, and half promising myself I'd do it next Thursday night, even if they didn't ask for boys and girls to. Hadn't Jesus died for boys and girls as well as for grown-ups? Even if I didn't know very much about it, I knew I loved him anyway. Portree didn't get up either, he being bashful on account of his voice being squawky, although I reckon that wouldn't really have made any difference to the Lord if Portree really loved him. Well, pretty soon, while the minister was talking again, Portree and I almost jumped out of our seats when he said,
"This afternoon, I was called to the hospital to see a man who was supposed to be a bank robber. He was just a young man, too, poor boy. He was all broken up about it. Said he hadn't done anything wrong and was out there in the swamp looking for something."
Portree, hand was gripping my arm so tight I could hardly keep from saying, "Ouch!" And then our minister asked us to pray for him that he might be saved, because he wasn't sure the boy'd ever get well, and even if he did get well, he ought to be saved anyway. Well, maybe Portree and I didn't pray out loud like some of the rest of them did, including my dad, but we prayed quietly anyway, even if our eyes were wide open. Pop prayed especially for that boy in the hospital, and then for all the boys in our neighborhood, and for all the boys in the world who, he said, would all grow up to be either good or bad men, according to whether they became Christians when they were boys. I guess Portree must have felt like I did, because I saw him put out his hand, well, put it up to his eye real quick-like, and brush away something. I was thinking, what if that boy had been one of the Sugar Creek gang, or even Portree or me? Of course, he was 18 years old, and I was only 10, but still, wow, it's quite a thought. Well, the next morning, my dad drove away in our car and was gone for about an hour and a half. When he came home, he said he'd been to the hospital to see Barry Boylan, which was the name of the robber, if he was one. Dad said, well, he's better, and the doctor thinks he'll get well in maybe a week or two. Dad was kind of happy, too. I saw him take his big black Bible out of the car and carry it into the house and lay it on the center table. Well, what else happened? Mom said.
Well, even if he doesn't get well, it'll be all right because he took Christ into his heart this morning, and he's saved now.
Mom seemed awful glad to hear that because she liked boys so well and wanted them all to be saved. And he wasn't a bank robber at all? She asked.
Well, they don't know yet. He says he wasn't. Says he lived out in California, that his parents were dead, that he used to have an uncle that lived around here somewhere, and he'd come to look him up. I asked him why he'd been carrying a gun, and he said somebody told him there were bears up in the hills, and he was afraid not to. And then when he saw the sheriff and his posse, he was so scared his gun accidentally discharged. They thought he was shooting at them, and because he had black hair like the robber was supposed to have had, they shot back at him. Just to prove he was really telling the truth, he showed me a picture of his uncle, which he had with him, and I brought it home for you to see.
Dad took out of his pocket a picture which was about the size of a postcard. Mom gasped like she was terribly surprised. Old man Padler. Why, let me see it. I got there as quickly as I could.
Oh, it's nothing. It's just the picture of an old man who used to live up in the hills, but who disappeared about 10 years ago when you were a little baby, Bill.
Dad handed the picture to me, and it was my turn to be surprised. In fact, I never was so surprised in my life before, because the picture looked exactly like Poetry did when he had had on the wig and long whiskers.
What's the matter, Bill?
Nothing. Did he really die 10 years ago?
Well, he must have, although nobody seems to know what became of him. His old cabin is still up in the hills where it was, and people say it's haunted, maybe because nobody knows what's happened to the old man, but anyway, I told Barry Boylan his uncle was dead, and he seemed very disappointed.
Well, you can guess that I, Bill Collins, was listening for all I was worth to what Dad was saying, and thinking, and trying to figure things out. The way Dad described the robber, he was the same one we'd seen yesterday digging around in the old hollow tree. I kept thinking about the wig and the whiskers and the dark glasses which Poetry found, and the funny map with the old man in bed. I thought maybe Barry's uncle must have been a crazy old hermit or something. Maybe he even drew the map himself, and maybe he buried it there in the old tree and buried the disguise there, too. But why? I asked myself. Well, anyway, maybe we boys would find out this afternoon, now that we knew there wasn't anything particularly to be afraid of. Well, it'd be like some new game, only a lot more mysterious. Pretty soon it was dinner time. And right after that, it was 1 o'clock, and the gang was all down at the spring. Circus, Dragonfly, Poetry, Little Jim with his gunny sack, Big Jim and his tape measure, and me, Bill Collins. First, I told them what Dad had said about the robber, not being a robber at all, and about him being saved. You should have heard Little Jim sigh with relief, just like he'd been carrying something heavy for a long time and somebody had suddenly lifted it off his shoulders. Even Circus seemed glad. And there happened to be an elm sapling right there, and he shinnied up it as quick as a squirrel and stood up on the first limb, slapped his hands against his legs like an old rooster flapping his wings after he just won a fight with another rooster. And then Circus crowed in a way that sounded exactly like our old red rooster at home. Well, we called a meeting and decided we'd start looking for the treasure or whatever it was right away, because maybe if we found it, we could help pay the hospital bill of Barry Boyland. You see, if he hadn't had any parents, maybe he wouldn't have enough money to pay it himself. And if he was a robber, well, then maybe we'd find the stolen money and get a reward. So pretty soon we were all there at the old tree again, measuring off 20 yards, which is the same as 60 feet, you know. Well, it looked like 60 feet was going to be right under the biggest rose bush of all, with the sharpest thorns. We measured all over again to be sure, and as near as we could figure out east, that was where it was, straight east. And that meant that whatever was buried there, if anything, must have been buried before the rosebush started to grow a long time ago. Well, we just walked round and round, all of us being barefoot. We couldn't decide what to do, and pretty soon Little Jim laid his gunny sack down right under the bush and laid himself down right on top of it and started raking away the leaves and dead grass with his stick. Before we knew it, he'd found something, because we could hear his stick scraping on something hard. Big Jim got excited then, and in a jiffy he was there, too, digging away with his woodsman hatchet, which he'd brought along. But we were all pretty disappointed at what they found. Nothing but a flat rock about a foot wide, all overgrown with moss and half buried in the earth. We all stood there looking and, as it, feeling spooky, for you could see as plain as day that it wasn't any ordinary rock. The fact is, it looked a little bit like an old-fashioned tombstone, like the kind we have in our church graveyard, only it was lying down instead of standing up. Big Jim was digging around it and was just about ready to pry it out and turn it over to see what was under it, or else what was written on the other side, when Dragonfly said,
"Psst! Somebody's watching us. I saw him right over there in the bushes."
I tell you, it didn't take Big Jim long to cover that stone over with dead leaves and dried grass, nor for all of us to start acting natural. Poetry was the first one to get started, having made 100 poems tucked away in his mind somewhere. He dropped flat on the ground, anyway as flat as he could, and made a mournful face, and with his hand up to his head, he said, "Humpty Dumpty sat on a wall. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. All the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put Humpty Dumpty together again." Circus was already lying on his back, swinging his feet up and down and saying, "One, two, one, two, one, two, up, down, whoop." Big Jim crawled out from under the rosebush, rubbed his eyes, and scolded us for waking him up. He said it so loud and looked so fierce that for a minute we thought he meant it. And then he yawned and looked awful sleepy, or acted like it. "Look, fellas. Look at these pretty yellow stamens all around the green and white center." I held up one of the roses I just picked. "Why, this rose has only 5 petals." A stamen, you know, is the organ in a flower that carries the pollen, and if flowers didn't have them, you could plant 1,000,000 seeds, and none of them would grow. But none of the boys were paying any attention to me, so I started looking for birds with my binoculars, and a jiffy I was looking at a red-winged blackbird swinging at the top of a little tree along the creek, his scarlet shoulders shining in the sun. I swung my binoculars around like I was looking for more birds, and in a jiffy, I saw somebody, sure enough, right over in the bushes. And would you believe? He looked like an old man with long white hair and whiskers, only he didn't have dark glasses on. Yes, sir, he looked exactly like the picture I had seen of old man Paddler less than 2 hours ago. I lowered my binoculars quick and looked around to see if Poetry was still with us, and he was. Well, that meant we'd have to stop looking for the treasure now and wait until we were sure nobody was watching us. In fact, Big Jim said we'd better all go in swimming and come back later. We were just starting to leave when the man came out from where he was hiding and began hobbling toward us looking like an awful old man. You could tell he was angry about something, for he waved his stick at us and shouted,
"Get out of here! Don't you know this property belongs to me, you little rascals? Get out, I say! Run, or I'll have the law on you!"
It's old man Paddler. And I started to run. In a jiffy, the whole gang was running helter-skelter through the woods just as fast as we could. And we didn't stop until we got to the spring, where we all dropped down on the grass and rested a minute so as to catch our breath and get cooled off before drinking.
"Did you ever see a man so mad in your life?" Dragonfly asked.
"I never did," Circus said, filling one of the paper cups and drinking. Of course, we'd all heard about old man Paddler living up in the hills a long time ago. We'd been up to his cabin 2 or 3 times. But he was supposed to be dead now. Everybody said so. But we'd seen him with our own eyes this afternoon, hadn't we? How can a man be dead and still be alive? Maybe we saw his ghost. My dad says this old swamp is haunted, but I never believed it before, Circus said.
"There isn't any such thing as ghosts. As my mother says, the Bible says that when a man's dead, he's dead for good, and that if he doesn't go to heaven, then he goes to that other place and nobody ever comes back again."
Somehow we all knew little Jim was right, he being a real Christian, but I decided to ask Dad about it when I got home that night. Anyway, Big Jim still had the map. He said it probably belonged to the old man, and we have to give it back to him. Maybe he had something buried there himself, and after being away for 10 years or more, he'd come back to get it. We decided not to go back today, but to keep it a secret about the old man, because we didn't want our folks to worry about us. When I got home, I had the grandest surprise waiting for me, and you never guess in the world. Dad said, "Let's hurry and get your chores done, Bill. You've been such a good boy that you may stay all night at Thompson's, and you and Poetry can sleep out in their backyard in his tent." Well, that was something I've been wanting to do ever since school was out, and Poetry had put up his tent. You can guess I didn't waste much time helping Dad with his chores, even if I ordinarily am kind of lazy about it.
Sleeping in that big canvas tent with poetry was the most fun I'd had in a long time. It was what is called a wall tent, about 8 feet high in the center and 4 feet high at the side walls, with about 8 inches of sod cloth all around the bottom, and with a drop screen in front to keep out mosquitoes. Only there weren't many mosquitoes around in our neighborhood because we boys, and my dad especially, poured oil on the surface of all the ponds and puddles in the swamp, being careful not to leave any water standing around in tin cans or kettles or things, because that's where mosquitoes breed. You know, mosquitoes are funny things. The kind we have in our neighborhood are what Dad calls the Culex kind, which don't carry any disease, such as malaria or yellow fever. Dad knows the scientific names for the kinds that do carry diseases, but they're too hard for me to pronounce, and, well, we'll just leave it at that. As I said, mosquitoes are crazy things, crazy looking and crazy acting. Did you ever see those little wrigglers swimming around in your folks' rain barrel or in a can of water or something? Well, those ugly little wiggle tails, as little Jim calls them, are baby mosquitoes that have hatched out of eggs which their mother laid in the water. Well, those little wrigglers keep growing and growing and wriggling until they're as big as they'll ever get. And then all of a sudden, they stop wriggling and float up to the surface of the water. They lie there just like they're dead until pretty soon the skin bursts open all the way along the back and out crawls a full-grown mosquito. She flies away all ready to stick her sharp nose into somebody, inject a little poison, and suck out some blood if she doesn't get slapped good and hard first. Say, does a mosquito bite ever itch? But if you put some soda water on it real quick, it'll feel a lot better right away. Well, my dad drove me over to Poetry's house and let me out at the front gate. Now, be sure to be a good boy, Bill. Which I didn't like to have him say very well, because I'd heard it maybe a million times in my life already, 1,000 times anyway. I guess maybe I needed it, though. Anyway, I wouldn't have liked it if my dad had wanted me to be bad, would you? So I called out, "Yep, I will." I was willing to promise most anything because Dad had been so good to me, let me stay all night with Poetry in his tent. I carried my little brown suitcase proudly up the walk and around the house to where Poetry's tent was pitched under a big maple tree. Poetry was so glad to see me, you'd have thought he hadn't seen me for a whole year. He lifted up the drop screen at the front of the tent, which was made of what is called bobbinet, a wide band of cheesecloth all around it for a border so it wouldn't tear so easy or wear out so quick. Pretty soon we were inside, and say, it was grand. There were 2 cots, one on each side with an aisle about 3 feet wide between them. In a corner, Poetry had a nice little table with books and things on it, such as a pocket knife, a compass, and Poetry's little black leather New Testament. Poetry was the kind of Christian who was brave and wasn't ashamed to let anybody know about it, while at the same time he was an honest-to-goodness boy that everybody liked. Maybe he was a little more mischievous than some boys, but I felt proud to have him as a friend, and my very best friend, for that matter. Pretty soon it'd be dark in the tent, so we decided to go outside. Poetry said, "I'm glad you brought your binoculars, because we might need them before morning." He didn't explain what he meant. However, we used them right away, looking around at different things. By standing up on Poetry's chicken house, we could look across the field and see the chimney of our house and the big green ivy vine that almost covered the whole south side. You could see the big south window of my upstairs room, which I always kept open when I slept, even in winter. That was one of the reasons why I had such good health. Well, pretty soon, while Poetry and I were standing up on their chicken house talking and thinking and liking each other awful well, Poetry's dad called out sharply from the barn,
"Leslie Thompson, get down off there right this minute. You're too heavy for that roof. Don't you know it might smash in and kill a half a dozen of your mother's finest laying hens?"
Not mentioning the fact it might smash Poetry, too.
All right.
I only weigh 140 pounds. I guess my being so short makes me look like 200. In a little while, it was dark, so we told Poetry's folks goodnight and went inside the tent where Poetry struck a match, which he took out of a waterproof matchbox, the kind everybody ought to have when they go camping. In a jiffy, there was plenty of light to see to undress by coming from a little kerosene lamp on the table in the corner. Pretty soon we had on our pajamas and were sitting on the edges of our cots, kind of hating to turn off the light and crawl in. I was wondering which one of us was going to say his prayers first. Maybe Poetry was thinking the same thing, because pretty soon he reached over and got his New Testament and handed it to me and said, "Let's read our chapters together tonight." I guess I forgot to tell you that Poetry and I had promised each other we'd read a chapter out of the New Testament at least once each day and that we'd pray for each other by name every night. Well, I turned to the book of Acts, which is the fifth book of the New Testament, and read about 15 verses. Anyway, it was the story about Paul and Silas having to go to jail for preaching the gospel and how they sang songs at midnight and were so happy because they loved Jesus so much in spite of being in jail with their feet all fastened tight in big wooden clamps or something. And then there was a big earthquake, and the jailer tried to kill himself with a sword. But instead, he became a Christian, and he and his whole family were baptized before morning. It was a great story, I tell you, and we liked it a lot. Poetry and I kind of liking each other like, well, Paul and Silas did. We made up our minds that if we ever had to go to jail for being Christians, we'd do it and we'd sing at midnight, too. Only, we wouldn't exactly want any earthquake. Then the two of us got down on our knees together beside Poetry's bed and said our prayers, only this time Poetry didn't say his little poem prayer at all, but just talked to the Heavenly Father with his own words. He explained afterward that he was getting a little bit too big to quote a little poem to God, so he decided to talk to him right out, knowing that he loved boys and girls and that Jesus had been a boy once himself. Soon the lights were out, and we were lying there in our cots, thinking and talking and telling each other stories and looking through the little square hole at the top of the tent entrance, which was open for fresh air. We looked up at the sky with the stars looking down at us like they were our best friends when Poetry started to say, "Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are, up above the world so high, like a diamond in the sky." I always did like that poem ever since I was little, so I made him quote all of it, liking especially the verse which goes, "In the dark blue sky you keep, and often through my curtains peep, for you never shut your eye till the sun is in the sky." Then we began to get sleepy, and in a minute we were gone. Say, did you ever wonder where a boy goes when he goes to sleep? Of course, you don't really go anywhere, because when you wake up, well, you're still right there in bed. Well, anyway, I was when I awakened a little later by the queerest noise coming from up in the old maple tree somewhere right above our heads. It sounded like somebody was crying or else moaning or wailing in a trembly voice. Of course, as soon as I was awake, I knew it was nothing but a screech owl and nothing to be afraid of. I'd seen plenty of them in the daytime. And they generally sit all alone in the hole in some old tree, sound asleep, waiting for night to come so they can go mouse hunting or maybe cutworm hunting. Dad says they're one of the farmer's best friends because at night, cutworms cause the most trouble cutting off the little corn shoots and beans and things like that. And since the screech owl hunts them at night, killing hundreds of them, boys ought never to kill any screech owls, no matter how much they don't like them. Poetry was awake, too, and pretty soon he whispered, "Hey, Bill, what do you want? I've got an idea." I was still pretty sleepy, so I just grunted. "Remember old man Paddler?" Huh, that woke me up quicker than anything. "Yes." And then that screech owl let out another long, trembly wail that sent the shivers up and down my spine. It's a whole lot different when you're home and upstairs in a bed listening to an owl out in the woods than it is sleeping in a tent, which is about the same as sleeping out of doors. But Poetry didn't pay any attention to the owl. I asked my dad a lot of questions about old man Paddler when I got home tonight without telling him anything, and he said that he was the kindest old man that ever lived and that he especially liked boys. I didn't answer, just waiting to see what else Poetry had to say, because I knew he thought of something important. I could hear his bedspring squeaking like he was getting up. "Wait till I scare that owl away, and I'll tell you." He fumbled around for his flashlight and turned it on a minute and stepped into his slippers and raised the tent flap and went out with me following right behind him, both of us in our pajamas, looking like a couple of ghosts. He turned the flashlight up into the tree for a minute, and we saw Mr. Owl with his cat-like eyes blinking and looking very fierce and disgusted at us for not appreciating his entertainment. And then he spread his wings and flew like a shadow across the garden toward the barn. Maybe I forgot to tell you that old sycamore tree down along the swamp was nearer to Poetry's house than it was to any of the rest of the gangs, being maybe not more than a quarter of a mile away. To get to it from Poetry's house, you had to go down a hill and through the woods. Well, we were standing there in the moonlight after the owl had flown away when Poetry said so sudden-like that it startled me, "If old man Paddler liked boys and was kind to them, and was even a Christian, as Dad says he was, then that wasn't him we saw today. Do you know what I think? I think the man we saw today was wearing a wig and false whiskers. I saw his hands, and they weren't any more an old man's hands than anything. I'll bet he's some robber or somebody that's trying to make people think he's Old Man Paddler so he can fool Barry Boyland and get the treasure. And I'll bet Barry knows there's a map and that when his uncle died, he left his money somewhere and he's coming back to get it. But what about the disguise you found in the tree? I couldn't figure out what Portree was driving at. They belong to the man we saw today. When I found them, he had to get some new ones. Well, that sounded sensible, and I told Portree so. Also, as long as Barry Boylan is in the hospital, it's up to us boys to protect his interest. Maybe we ought to tell the police, thinking what my dad would say we ought to do. Not on your life. Think we want to have them spoil our fun? Well, I didn't want to argue with Portree. Besides, his ideas were nearly always right. We started to get back into the tent when he stopped so quick I bumped into him. Listen. I didn't hear anything, but I did see something that looked like a light down in the woods, maybe not far from the sycamore tree. Get your binoculars, quick. Portree handed me his flashlight and in a jiffy. I was in the tent and out again, and Portree was looking through my binoculars down the hill toward where we knew the tree was. Look! He handed the binoculars to me, and all I could see was a light and a shadow moving about it. We gotta do something quick. We wouldn't even have time to dress. In a jiffy, he was in the tent and out again with the disguise he'd found in the old tree the day before. Well, what are you gonna do? He was putting on his big shoes while I was asking the question. Let's go or we're gonna be too late. Well, I didn't exactly want to run smack into any ghosts or whatever was down along the swamp, but I didn't want to seem like a coward either, so I followed him as fast as I could. The wind was blowing on our faces, so we knew whoever was there wouldn't hear us coming unless we made a lot of noise. Say, Portree looked ridiculous in his big flapping white pajamas, and I guess I looked just as ridiculous running after him. He knew every inch of the woods along the creek here, so we just hurried along, me thinking his idea was still crazy. Well, dangerous anyway. When we got to the bottom of the hill, we stopped to get our breath and to look through the binoculars again. As plain as day, we could see an old-fashioned lantern, and a man was digging with a spade right beside the swamp rose bush where we'd been digging that afternoon. We'll have to hurry. Look, what a big hole he's got already. We stooped down low and crawled along as quiet as we could until we were real close. So close, if we'd made any noise, he'd have heard us, and that would have spoiled everything. We could see the man, too. The same old man we'd seen in the afternoon, with the long white hair and the long beard, and he was working terribly fast. And then I looked at Portree and guessed what he was going to do, for he was putting on the whiskers and the wig which he had brought along with him. He whispered in my ear, "Listen, you lie flat on the ground, right here, and when I let out a long ghost laugh, you turn the flashlight on me quick and leave it on until I start moaning and talking crazy, and then you turn it off. When I start laughing again, you turn it on again, quick." Portree stood up then and started waving his arms like a crazy man, and then with that squawky voice of his that sounded more like a ghost than any real ghost could have sounded, he let out a blood-curdling wail that sounded like a screech out with a bad cold. I turned the flashlight on him just as he started that wailing. Honest, if I didn't know who he was, I'd have been scared almost to death, for he was waving his arms and his pajamas were flapping crazily, and it was enough to scare anybody. And then Portree started the awfulest moaning you ever heard.
"I am Old Man Paddler's ghost."
And then Portree let out that terrible laugh and sent the shivers up and down my spine again. And I turned the flashlight on him and watched him waving his white pajamas and looking even worse than a ghost. Well, sir, that man dropped his spade and looked around like he was awful scared. In a flash, he jumped up and dashed lickety-sizzle straight toward Portree with both hands stretched out in front of him like he was going to grab Portree and choke him to death. But just that second, two shadows darted out from behind some bushes. One of them made a dive for the man's legs in real football style, and a voice, it was Big Jim's voice, yelled for us to come and help. Oh, I tell you, I was glad to hear Big Jim's voice. To tell the truth, I was pretty badly scared, not wanting to let Portree know it.